Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. Well, today's Happy Buddha's Death Day. We do tend to like death days in Buddhism more than birthdays. We do celebrate the Buddha's birthday, but then there's death days besides that. Take a look sometime at the Buddha behind you, you know, after the service if you'd like. That's the typical reclining death pose of the Buddha. Looks very relaxed. He's telling us something. So it's a chance celebrating Buddha's death day. I have not been great at doing it. Sometimes we miss it and I just move on, but I'm not going to do that anymore. We're going to celebrate all six of these major feast days, and this is one of them. And it's a chance for me, certainly, to reflect upon the Buddha's death. And what it means to me. And when I'm... That works. When I'm doing that... So I've been reading the classic sutta, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. The Enlightenment Day sometimes is called the Buddha's Nirvana, and then this is his Parinirvana, his final Nirvana. Sorry. I like this period of his life. I find it interesting, I find it interesting that, you know, what he's interested in the last part of his life. He spent 50 years gathering a sangha together, making lots of rules for that sangha, lots of forms to be followed. And he's taught and taught and taught. And he's been the guy throughout those years. And then at the end of his life, I find he's not interested. I find what he's not interested in interesting. He's not interested in a smooth succession plan. You know, as I would be, or a neat structure for what goes on next. Zen actually makes up a story later that the Buddha did make a succession structure. He gave the robe and the bowl to Mahakashyapa, and then there was a line of succession after that. That was all made up a long time later by the Chinese, because that was important to the Chinese, that kind of structure be in place. But for the Buddha, he was not interested in that stuff. He was interested in making sure that his disciples were strong and clear-thinking and self-reliant. That's what I read when I read his last chapter. He really wants his students, he wants to make sure that his students are thinking for themselves, not just relying on him. And so he's wandering the first part of the sutta, it's a long sutta, with lots of monks, and they come to Shariputra's hometown. Shariputra, everybody knows, he's one of the top disciples of the Buddha, known to be the most brilliant one, the really smart one. The Heart Sutra, talking to Shariputra, because Avalokiteshvara is making sure that Shariputra, the really smart one, knows that emptiness is the real deal. So he comes to Shariputra's town, and Shariputra comes out and says, greets him, says hello to the Buddha, wonderful that you came. And Shariputra says, he praises the Buddha. Now, I just looked this up to get the, this is how modern I am. But he says, I'm just going to quote here. The Shariputra says, this faith, Lord, I have in the Blessed One, that there has not been, there will not be, nor is there now, another recluse or Brahmin more exalted in enlightenment than the Blessed One. And the Buddha says, lofty indeed is this speech of yours, Shariputra, and lordly. A bold utterance, a veritable sounding of a lion's roar. Anybody subscribe to Lion's Roar magazine? That's where this comes from. This is known as the Lion's Roar. Shariputra's Lion's Roar. It's funny that it's named that, this this magazine, because there's some irony there, you'll see. It says, oh, that's a lion's roar. But how is this, Shariputra? Those arhats, fully enlightened ones of the past, do you have direct personal knowledge of all those blessed ones? As to their virtue, their meditation, their wisdom, their abiding? No, no, I don't, Lord. Then how is this, Shariputra? If you don't know that, how can you say that I am the best ever? You just can't. So that's his teaching to Shariputra, that you say what you know. Don't assume that I'm the best. And rely on your personal, direct experience. So, then, yeah, the Buddha goes to the next town, and there is magic in these sutras. More magic than you or I might be comfortable with. The Buddha is looking forward one of his gifts is he can see what kind of lives the people in will have next. So he goes to this town, and there's been a number of people who died recently, and so he consoles them as a kind of pastor would, but by telling them that, oh, their lives will be this, that, and the other. But then he talks to his disciples, and he says, you know, you too, it's a similar theme, I think, you too will be able to see this. It's called the Mirror Dharma Sermon. You will be able to see you will be able to feel your own, destiny, as it were. If you practice. He doesn't talk about other people's. He just says about your own. He says you will be able to feel that you are headed toward awakening. So look at yourself. Don't just rely on my magic powers. I think, regardless of the kind of supernatural stuff in this, you can feel that the Buddha has an instinct to democratize. I feel that in these old sutras. You too can do this. You don't have to rely on me. I wonder whether that's partly because of his upbringing. He comes from the Sakya clan. And if you, as I did, I'd always heard this, but then I read the Wikipedia article on the Sakya clan. And it's true, it was a kind of proto-democracy. It had a, or democratic oligarchy. There was a, the leader was chosen from among the warrior class by election, and then they made decisions collectively. And that's the kind of milieu in which he grew up, the Buddha. So then, after traveling some, the Buddha decides to do his final rains retreat, because during the rainy season they would go into retreat in this one area by Sala. And there's famine in the area at that time. So he tells his retinue to spread out, not so as not to burden one community with, you know, all the begging. So everybody spreads out, kind of solo style. And he and Ananda are just by themselves for this last chapter. So he spends a lot of time here with Ananda in retreat. And during that time, the Buddha falls ill, gravely ill. He's 80 years old. He's in frail health. He has some line about how he's just a cart that's being, like, held together by twine at this point. But Ananda takes care of him, and he recovers. And Ananda's happy when he recovers, because the Buddha says, he tells the Buddha, "I'm so glad you got better, because essentially you haven't named a successor yet. And you haven't given the last minute, our last instructions to the Sangha yet." And the Buddha's surprised that Ananda says this. He says, "What more does the community of bhikkhus expect from me?" Ananda, "I have set forth the Dhamma without making any distinction between esoteric or exoteric doctrine. I've laid it all out for you. There is nothing, Ananda, with regard to the teachings that the Tathagata holds to the last with a closed fist of a teacher who keeps something back." He says, "I'm not a closed fist teacher. I'm an open hand teacher." His teachings are in plain sight, not for just one student. And I think he has this even-handed approach to teaching. As I said, maybe that comes from his Sakya clan upbringing. And then the Buddha says, and this is sometimes spun as his last words, though it's not. He says, "The bhikkhus should be a lamp unto themselves." The actual literal translation is "island unto themselves." Doesn't sound as good, island, as lamp. So you can't actually translate that lamp, though most people say, no, it should be island. We can ask Elizabeth when she looks at the Sanskrit. I should say, by the way, that goes from Sanskrit, I mean Pali, to Sanskrit, to Chinese. So you see different things in different versions. But whatever translation you use, the intent I think is the same. He's telling the bhikkhus they should think for themselves and rely on their own insight. Please don't misunderstand this. I often feel the need to say, remember the context. He's not talking to individual people at home. He's talking to a group of monks who have agreed to the rules of the Sangha, to customs, to meeting together, all this. So it's not as if he's telling them to go out and be islands unto themselves. I think what he's saying is, don't rely on me. Don't rely on me. He says this too, interestingly. Don't take refuge in external things. Remember the three refuges? Don't take refuge in external things. Take refuge in the Dharma that you've learned. And do the practice that I've taught and let it teach you. Very strong about this. And I think this is a fundamental Buddhist value. We practice together, and I feel that that's extremely important to practice together in a Sangha. And at the same time, we have to know that anybody can see clearly, can gain the Buddha's wisdom, if they apply themselves. This is echoed by the Zen master Rinzai, who this school of Zen is named after. What do students today lack? Faith in themselves is what ails them. He says, it's only because you lack confidence in yourself that you go looking for something outside of yourself. In Zen, in Buddhism, we don't need this intermediary, a priest or a holy person to connect us to the deepest wisdom. We find it ourselves, and that's freeing. We can do it ourselves. But it's also a burden. It's up to you. You can do it. You have to do it. That's the two sides of that coin. You have to pick up the mantle. You have to do the work. Nobody's going to do it for you. You have to take initiative with this practice if you really want to get something out of it. It's not enough just to read about it. It's not even enough just to practice it. If you really want to gain the fruits of Buddha's practice, you have to put yourself into it. And part of that path is developing the strength and the courage, I think, to come to your own understanding of this path. To listen, to learn from others, and then to come to your own understanding. That's the Zen way. And I think, I just gave a talk when I was in Norway on humanism and Zen. So I still have the 18th century guys ringing in my head. So Kant says of the Enlightenment, sapare aude, dare to know. That fits with Buddhism, Buddhist values, I think. Have the courage to use your own understanding. And I think the Buddha really wanted his students to have that kind of courage, to use your own understanding, to put yourself into practice. So that's what I see the Buddha doing as in his last weeks, is calling on his students to stand on their own two feet. And in Zen, we ask you to do the same thing, to take responsibility for your practice, and not to be a passive recipient of the teaching, but to find ways to take initiative with your practice. Come to Dokusan, ask a question for Christ's sake. Question yourself. Do Zazen on your own, not just here, if you can summon the strength to do that. And when you do Zazen, lean into it. Don't just wait. In order to do Zen practice, you really do have to work on the inside. You have to work on yourself. And I think the Buddha knew this. He worked at his own realization. It wasn't cheap. He really put himself into that question. What is this all about? He saw somebody dying. That was the thing that kicked him out onto the path in the end. Am I going to die? He asked his charioteer. Is this going to happen to me? Yes, sire, it's going to happen to you. And then he goes, what's this all about? So then the Ananda and the Buddha are together for some time, and the story continues, and as some of you probably know, the Buddha eats something called, the sutra calls it pig's delight. There's been 2,500 years of talk about what that might be. Was he eating pig after all? Does that mean we can eat pig too? Or does it mean that it was what pigs love, which is the common thing, you know, probably truffles or mushrooms of some kind, right? So bad mushrooms. It's given to him by a blacksmith for a feast, Kunda. It's very sweet. A couple of times in the last, this last day or two of the Buddha's life, he's really concerned that Kunda, don't blame him. You know, it was a great deal of merit that he got from giving this food to me. Don't, because he knows that Kunda might really catch it for killing the Buddha. So then he finally situates himself between two solid trees. It's the solid tree that his mother hung on to when giving birth. He, between two, his head headed north. And then, magically, his monks find him, or maybe they were called, I don't know. Anyway, they all come around. And here's what he says at the end. He says, it may be after I've gone, some of you will think, now we have no teacher. But that's not how you should see it. Let the Dharma and the discipline that I have taught you be your teacher. He says, behold, O monks, this is my last advice to you. All individual things pass away. Strive on untiringly or diligently. This, by the way, is the message of the Han. You hear the Han being hit? The message of that Han, what's traditionally written on it, is life and death are great matters. Time flies toward death. Please don't waste it. Please use this life to understand. Work diligently. And you must do it. You must know for yourself. You can learn from books, learn from teachers and from fellow travelers, and all those are very valuable. But there's no substitute for you putting yourself into this work. You have to test the path. These Buddhist principles are hypotheses. You have to test them. In a sense, you have to make your own path. I felt that very directly when I went to the monastery, when I went to Mount Bodhi Zen Center. The ritual was, you know, five times the amount of here. I was told when to get up and when to sit down and when to go to the bathroom and when to eat and how to eat and on and on and on. But I thought, somebody forgot to tell me how to sit. What I should be doing on the cushion. There was little talk about that. About how actually to work with my mind and how to get quiet. The teacher, Sasaki Roshi, would, you know, say, oh, yeah, full moon in the sky. And that was wonderful, you know, heartening. But it wasn't exactly a roadmap. And I feel that is something that Zen kind of does. It puts a pretty clear container in. And then it says, okay, you, find your way there. Use your own initiative. Be resourceful. Be creative to find your way there. Use all of the little, you know, whatever's in your Swiss Army knife. And so I often think resourcefulness, especially in the Zen tradition, is a spiritual gift and quality that we have to develop. And that way, we get to know ourselves, we get to know our inner landscape, we get to know, because we're blazing our own paths, we get to know our landscape, our inner landscape. And it's not just one way that we learn. We learn lots of different ways to find that quiet place within ourselves. Yeah, well, I don't know if it's all that work diligently sounds exhausting, but you know, we are animals. We are meant to. We want good tasting food. That's perfectly natural. We are meant to follow, to learn how to responsibly follow our desires. I believe that. That's fine and good. But that there should be more than that to our lives. And Zen is a way to find some meaning through work that will stand us in good stead through our whole life, through ups and downs of life. We do that in community and with teaching from the, not just me, from generations and other teachers as well. But in the end, we have to do it ourselves. And there's no other way to put it. So that's what I think about on Nirvana Day, the Buddha's pointing out that we have to do this work ourselves. So please do, please take initiative with your practice and work at it. If I can help, let me know. I'm kind of a coach, but sometimes I say, you know, I'm more cheerleader than coach. You can do it. You can do it. But you have to do it.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.